love of Scarlatti and other composers in just a moment. That's after a summary of the BBC News with the time now at 1 o'clock. It's read by Vaughan Savage.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, says the government will put forward proposals next month to put more checks on executive pay increases. He said the government was prepared to bring in laws to ensure greater transparency about boardroom pay decisions. Mr. Clegg stressed that the government wouldn't be trying to set pay rates in the private sector. The former Labour Minister, Lord Hutton, who reviewed public sector pensions for the Coalition, has said the current economic situation makes the need for change more urgent. In a BBC interview, he describes the government's position as perfectly credible, although he warns some workers might leave the schemes if contributions rise too much. Russians are voting in parliamentary elections, which are being seen as a test of the popularity of the Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin. He's preparing to stand again for the presidency in 3 months' time. A bomb has exploded outside the British Embassy in the capital of Bahrain, Manama. There were no casualties or damage to the building. Officials said the blast happened in a minibus in a public car park. Solihull Hospital in the West Midlands is re-examining the mastectomies of more than 500 breast cancer patients after it was discovered their surgeon had used an experimental technique. The surgeon, Ian Patterson, is being investigated. The recurrence rate of cancer wasn't above average in his patients. The former captain of the Brazil football team, Socrates, has died in hospital at the age of 57. He'd been suffering from an intestinal infection. Socrates played in 2 World Cups and won 60 caps for his country. 2 giant pandas are expected to arrive in Edinburgh about now from China. The animals, Yuan Guang and Tian Tian, will be the first pandas to live in Britain for 17 years. Edinburgh Zoo hopes the 8-year-olds, who are on loan for 10 years, will breed. The weather, there'll be frequent heavy and blustery showers across northwest Britain. Some of them will be wintry. It'll be rather cloudy in southern Britain with occasional showers. The BBC News and weather at 1:02.
Vaughan, thank you very much. Choral Vespers comes from the Brompton Oratory in London this afternoon at 4:00, and there's more choral music an hour later when Alad Jones introduces the close harmony virtuosity of the Birmingham-based group Black Voices. And you can experience a concise history of the Red Army Choir, still setting the benchmark for military music making after 80 years. The choir is at 5:00 this afternoon. But now, Catherine Bott with today's edition of the Early Music Show, celebrating the 300th anniversary of the birth of the Portuguese Infanta Maria Bárbara.
A chilly January day in 1729. The roads that lead to the banks of the River Caia are almost impassable, sheeted with ice and pillowed with snowdrifts. 2 families have made the arduous journey to a carefully chosen meeting place for a double wedding, which will take place in a magnificent pavilion specially built to lie across the river so that all parties can meet without ever going out of their own territories, entering just at the same instant, step by step. Sounds rather more protocol-ridden than the average wedding, but the river is the clue. The Caia is where Spain and Portugal meet. And on this January day, on opposite banks, stand the Spanish and Portuguese royal families, each with equally vast retinues of servants and soldiers. In the midst of all this one-upmanship are 4 young people, the Crown Princely pawns in this dynastic game, each bride and groom meeting for the first time. 3 of them are in their teens. 1, Mariana Victoria of Spain, is not yet 11. She is to wed José of Portugal. Her big brother Fernando will marry José's 17-year-old sister, Maria Bárbara. Jordi Savall, directing Le Concert des Nations, in music by the Italian-born composer Francisco Corselli, 28 years old at the time of that cold and watery Iberian double wedding. He went on to flourish at the Spanish court of one of the happy couples, Fernando VI, and his bride, Maria Barbara, the subject of today's early music show. And to find out why she merits a whole programme to herself, listen on. Maria Maddalena Barbara Xavier Leonor Teresa Antonia Josefa of Portugal was named after quite a number of saints when she was born on St. Barbara's Day, the 4th of December in 1711. The longed-for first child of King João V and his wife, the former Archduchess Maria Anna of Austria. They had been married for 3 years, and the king had made a promise to God that if only they could be blessed with an heir, then he would build a great convent in thankfulness. And so he did. Well, in truth, the convent of Mafra was more of a palace. It's one of the grandest Baroque buildings in Portugal, and today, a national monument, it looms large over the town of Mafra, northwest of Lisbon. The convent/palace was finally inaugurated, still incomplete, the year after Maria Barbara's wedding. You might say that princess and palace grew up together. And the king lavished time, money, and good taste on both his pet projects. Despite her being reduced in the royal rankings from heiress presumptive after the birth of her brother José, she still merited a fine education in all the usual subjects, including, of course, music. And here's where the early music show comes in. Many a royal personage has dabbled in music, but Maria Barbara played the harpsichord to a very high standard, and even composed, thanks largely to the extraordinary musical relationship that developed between her and the Italian appointed to teach her when she was about 9 years old, Domenico Scarlatti.
Thank you.
Pierre Antaille playing a fugue by Domenico Scarlatti, teacher and mentor to the Portuguese infanta Maria Barbara. Why did Scarlatti, successful enough, a harpsichordist who could outplay Handel, why did he take himself to Lisbon in his early 30s? Well, you don't have to be the offspring of a great monarch to have difficulties in establishing your own identity. There are royal families in music, too. Domenico's father, Alessandro, was not only one of the most famous and admired composers of opera in all Italy. He seems to have been a rather controlling sort of man, and Domenico found the going hard when he set out on his own career. He gave up an important post at the Vatican in August 1719, and after that, facts are a little sparse, but he was probably in Lisbon a year later. In the 1720s, King Juan and his court sat contentedly on a cushion of colonial treasure. Frederick the Great of Prussia commented on the king's strange passion for churchly ceremonies, so who better for his new chapelmaster than a man who'd worked at the Vatican? One of the reasons so few details are available to modern students of Scarlatti is that the terrible Lisbon earthquake of 1755 saw many records obliterated. But at New Year 1722, the Gazzetta de Lisboa reported on a Thanksgiving service which included a Te Deum elegantly composed by the famous Domingos Scarlatti. One of his tasks was to teach music to the young Maria Barbara, and from this time onwards, most of his compositional output consisted of keyboard music for her to play. Virginia Black with one of Scarlatti's most virtuosic sonatas, number K24 in A major. Could Maria Barbara get round all those notes? It's nice to think she could. After all, she did study for years with a great keyboard virtuoso. Contemporary accounts praise her as an exceptionally accomplished musician, which is no surprise given her ancestry. Her great-grandfather, King Zhuang IV, had amassed a huge music library, all but the catalogue lost in the earthquake, and her maternal grandfather, Leopold I of Austria, had composed several oratorios and suites of more than merely royal competence. Official portraits did her far more than justice. She was no beauty. Sir Benjamin Keane, British ambassador to the Spanish court, pulled no punches in recalling Prince Fernando's first sight of her on their wedding day. Her large mouth, thick lips, high cheekbones and small eyes afforded him no agreeable prospect. But she is well-shaped and has a good mien. And she also inspired affection. Sir Benjamin became very fond of her, and her husband's devotion was lifelong. He was known as Fernando the Learned, and his wife's intellectual gifts were as valuable to him as her musical talents were soothing. When the newlyweds moved to Madrid, Maria Barbara took with her not only her harpsichords, but also her beloved music teacher. Domenico Scarlatti had already made a career move from Italy to Portugal. He was to spend the rest of his life in Spain.
Thank you.
Scarlatti's Sonata in C Major, K132, played by Andreas Steyer. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott. Maria Barbara of Portugal must have needed her music sessions with Scarlatti when she began her new life in Spain. She had to deal with the in-laws. Felipe V was regarded by everyone as a weak king, perhaps mentally unstable too. His wife, Elisabetta Farnese, seems to have taken a very dim view of her poor ailing husband and effortlessly dominated his life. She also loathed her stepson Fernando's new wife. One imagines Maria Barbara hiding herself away and doing rather a lot of harpsichord practice. But after 8 demanding years, Maria Barbara and Fernando must have been hugely cheered by the arrival in Madrid of one of the greatest artists of a generation, the castrato Farinelli. An aria by Hasse, as featured on the soundtrack of the film Farinelli, Christophe Rousset directing Les Talents Lyriques, with the artfully morphed voices of soprano Eva Malas-Godlewska and countertenor Derek Lee Reagan. The castrato voice being the only thing that the early music movement is content not to restore. Carlo Maria Broschi probably became the sublime singer Farinelli through the untimely death of his father. The Broschis were plunged into poverty, and young Carlo's heavenly voice could earn a fortune if it were preserved by drastic surgery. He became a truly great singer in demand all over Europe, as one swooning English fan said, "One God, one Farinelli." In the summer of 1737, he received an official invitation to visit the Spanish court, and soon found himself in demand as a sort of music therapist to the king, who was severely depressed and refusing to get out of bed. Farinelli's singing soothed Philip and made him biddable, and the Spanish made him an offer he couldn't refuse. According to commentator Charles Burney, it was determined that he should be taken into the service of the court, not being suffered to sing again in public. For almost 10 years, Farinelli was well paid for singing to the king every night to help him get to sleep, not just singing to him, always the same 4 songs. His influence over the royal household was immense, but he never abused his position, instead concentrating on treading carefully round the queen's wily little ways and forging a real friendship with Maria Barbara and Fernando, based on their shared devotion to all things musical. Farinelli's presence in Madrid made Italian opera all the rage, and with royal encouragement, productions became ever more spectacular.
Torbido il cielo e la minaccia morte prepara, morte prepara. Tutto mi ispira rimorso e orror, tutto mi ispira rimorso e orror, rimorso e orror, tutto mi ispira rimorso e orror. lungo il cielo, pena minaccia, morte prepara, tutto mi ispira rimorso e orror, rimorso e orror, tutto mi ispira rimorso e orror, torbido il cielo, morte prepara, pallido il sole, pena minaccia, tutto mi ispira rimorso e orror, rimorso e orror. Tutto mi ispira rimorso e orror, rimorso e orror. Timor mi cinge, ti freddo cielo, volor mi rende la vita amara. Io stesso fremo, canto il mio cor, canto il mio cor. Torbido il cielo, pena minaccia, morte prepara, tutto mi ispira rimorso e orror, tutto mi ispira rimorso e orror, rimorso e orror, tutto mi ispira rimorso e orror. Pallido il sole, torbido il cielo, pena minaccia, morte prepara, tutto mi ispira rimorso e orror, rimorso e orror, tutto mi ispira rimorso e orror. Torbido il cielo, morte prepara, pallido il sole, pena minaccia, tutto mi ispira rimorso e orror, rimorso e orror.
Countertenor Andreas Scholl and the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, conducted by Roger Norrington, in an aria that was a pan-European hit from Hasse's opera Artaserse, staged in Spain during Farinelli's time there. When the poor old king died in 1746, the popular saying was that it is rather Barbara succeeding Elisabetta than Fernando succeeding Felipe. The new king's dependence on his wife was considerable, but together they achieved a lot. Banishing Elisabetta and her coterie, they initiated banking and trading reforms, the modernisation of the navy, a thawing of relations between church and state, and a flourishing artistic climate. Very pleasant for Farinelli, who, despite his natural modesty and affability, did rather enjoy being lionised. And for Scarlatti. Given the general admiration for Scarlatti's vast output of keyboard music today, it's tempting to imagine him as the leading light in Maria Barbara's musical circle. Not so. We have Farinelli to thank for writing about Scarlatti in his memoirs and correspondence, because the composer himself was more of a backroom boy. He'd found his niche. He and his wife raised a family. He continued to enjoy his friendship with the Queen, continued writing music for her. Music filled with the everyday sounds of Spain, its colours, its instruments, its dance.
Thank you.
A flamenco-inspired sonata by Domenico Scarlatti that could only have come from Spain. Pierre Antaille played Kirkpatrick number 175. And Ralph Kirkpatrick is someone from nearer our own time who did a great deal to make sure the world knew more of Scarlatti. As well as writing a magisterial biography, Kirkpatrick catalogued all the works. So that's what the expression K-number is short for. Maria Barbara longed to grant her dear mentor Scarlatti some official honour, but couldn't accomplish that in Spain. So she asked her father, the man who had first had the bright idea of inviting Scarlatti to Portugal. And in 1738, King João announced that, "I see fit to award to Domingos Escarlati the cloak of the Order of Santiago." A great honour. And in gratitude, Scarlatti dedicated to the king his first published collection of harpsichord pieces. A few years after being raised to this high station, Scarlatti, by now a widower, married a Spanish woman and lived contentedly in Madrid until 1757, when he completed his last work, a Salve Regina, and died aged 71.
Thank you.
Domenico Scarlatti's setting of the Salve Regina, sung by Marie-Nicole Lemieux, with Tafel music directed by Jean Lamont. Maria Barbara mourned Scarlatti deeply. A contemporary wrote that she had learnt from him the most intimate knowledge of music and its profoundest artifices. And she herself called him fondly Don Domingo Escarlatti, my music master, who has followed me with great diligence and loyalty. A year later, she followed him to the grave. Fernando was heartbroken and didn't long survive her. There were no children of their marriage. Fernando was succeeded by his half-brother Carlos III, who had no taste for the arts. Farinelli departed for a lonely old age in Bologna, and an era was over in Spain. Perhaps the true legacy of Maria Barbara is to be heard in the 550 sonatas that her teacher Scarlatti wrote in celebration of her love of music and her skill in playing.
She really must have been quite some keyboardist, if that sonata is anything to go by. The sonata in D minor, Kirkpatrick 517, by Scarlatti, played there by Andreas Steyer. Today's early music show on Maria Barbara of Portugal and Spain was presented by Catherine Bott, and the programme was produced by Chris Wines. And don't forget the weekly early music show podcast. You can find full details on the Radio 3 website. Well, a very good afternoon to you. This is BBC Radio 3, the time now just after 2 o'clock, and it's time to revisit an important event in the musical year, which took place in London last Wednesday. It was introduced for us by Sarah Moore-Peach and Andrew McGregor.
Well, this is the bustle of Stationers' Hall in London, the beautiful wood-panelled livery building just tucked away around the corner from St Paul's Cathedral, where we're surrounded by composers, publishers, and a handful of performers as well for this year's British Composer Awards.
These awards celebrate the best in British new music. It's promoted by BASCA, the British Academy of Songwriters, Composers and Authors. There are 13 categories of awards, ranging from orchestral to outreach, jazz to liturgical, chamber to choral.
And we're going to be hearing highlights from the awards ceremony itself. We'll be learning more about some of the winning composers in person, and also from this evening's keynote speech maker, Michael Barclay. And we'll be hearing some of the winning compositions in full.
First of all, we've got live music from the ceremony itself. The first award of the evening is the Student Competition Prize, a special category introduced for the first time only last year, in which entrants are asked to write a new piece to a very specific brief. This year, the test was to write a short movement for string quartet, and the winner, a unanimous choice from the jury, was April by Wenjing Wang.
The piece is written for string quartet. I read a book by a female author, which I thought she is very beautiful on expressing her words for novels. Immediately, I got an idea that in my mind, there is a picture of sound that can be converted on strings, and there are three movements in the piece, and each of them presented a different sound world, a very kind of different imaginic texture, imaginic sound, and different color. I tried to explore different colors in each movement, and the first is like very lightly atmosphere, and the second is about a flower and a very sensitive sense of the feeling to the novel, and the last one is about the song, which in the novel, when I read the sentence and even the word, I can feel the sunshine, very sensitive feeling about the nature.
April by Wenjing Wang, winner of the Student Competition Award at the British Composer Awards 2011. And that was the performance given live at the award ceremony itself by the Heath Quartet. Oliver Heath, Keris Jones, Gary Pomeroy and Christopher Murray. Beautiful sounds to begin the ceremony, Sarah.
Really wonderful. What was lovely was how, basically how quiet they were and how they focused everybody's attention. And the 13 awards that are to follow, an amazing variety, which I think is always a feature of the British Composer Awards.
Yeah, if you think you know what composition, classical composition means in the 21st century in this country, there's always a surprise, even a shock, when you start going through the nominations and hearing the excerpts. We've got Alice in Wonderland, we've got a seabird in a jazz ensemble piece, there's a brass band piece on a pit disaster, there's a piece which is based around 19th century communications hubs in Cornwall, and that's as well as the usual classical things, your sonatas, fantasias, and the kinds of things you might expect.
Absolutely, and you know, every year, whatever the financial climate is, whatever state of affairs we think we're in, I go to these awards and I think, well, composition today is in great health. So this is how the award ceremony started.
The first award this evening is in the category for liturgical music. The nominated works in this category were all commissioned for specific occasions, two at Westminster Abbey and a third at St Paul's Cathedral, just a short distance from where we're gathered here this evening, currently hosting a slightly less formal gathering of its own.
The Abbey bells were the inspiration for one of the works. Another was commissioned for the Feast of Pentecost, and the occasion of the visit of Pope Benedict XVI gave rise to the third commission. The forces range from choir and orchestra to double chorus to eight-part a cappella choir.
The nominated works are Bell Mass by Julian Anderson, the first of two nominations for Julian this evening, Missa Spiritus Sancti by Francis Greer, and The Glory of the Lord by Gabriel Jackson.
Now, all three of these composers happen to have been nominated in 2007 in various categories as well, so who takes the first award this evening remains to be seen.
But first, the view of the judges, who commented on the apparent paradox between the tradition that liturgical music imposes and the possibility of freshness and originality. All three nominated works, they said, successfully resolve this paradox, and their special admiration was reserved for the winning work, which combines old and new with integrity and vision.
The winning work in the 2011 British Composer Awards category for liturgical music is Bell Mass by Julian Anderson.